the blessings and benefits accomplished in the fund. Thank you, Brother Roger.
Well, thank you, Brother David, and my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. Well, it's one of those days, or shall I say one of those evenings, when it's hard to stay awake. But I do hope that you're going to stay with me as we come through these last few verses, because there are some marvellous thoughts to be found as the Apostle brings his thinking upon the fund to a conclusion, at least as far as his appeal was concerned to the ecclesias of Achaia. So just to catch up where we were, you'll remember that so far we've come through, of course, the 2nd of Corinthians chapter 8. We've seen how the Apostle appealed for them that they might enthusiastically give to the fund, how that they might cooperate for the good of the fund, and how in the first few verses of the 9th chapter, how they might give liberally to the fund. And remember, as we've seen, that in all of these requests that the Apostle was making, in all of these appeals, it's not just, of course, the fund that he has in mind. That the principle of enthusiastic support for the truth, the principle of cooperation together, and the principle of sowing bountifully were in fact to be the parts of a guiding spirit in whatever they would do in the activities and in the labours of the truth, of which the poor fund was but an illustration of that which should pervade their every action and every enterprise. Well, in the 8th verse now, as we come to the last section of the 9th chapter, we see now how the Apostle Paul is going to take up from where he left off last time. And in the course of our considerations this evening, we're going to see how the Apostle stresses now the blessings and the benefits that would be accomplished in the fund. Almost as if the Apostle's mind now runs forward and he thinks about the tremendous things that are going to be achieved by the time he gets back to Jerusalem. And also he reminds them of God's power to bless the generous hearted. So one of the themes that the Apostle is going to bring out in these closing verses is how, having exhorted them to give bountifully, he's going to say, and you must realize, brethren, says the Apostle, that in giving bountifully, that God is able to reward you for that spirit of generosity. You'll, in a sense, receive back what you have given. Well, let's have a look first of all then at the verses that we're going to look at this evening. So the 2nd of Corinthians chapter 9 and the 8th verse to the 15th. In verses 8 to 11 then, this is what the Apostle says. He reminds the brethren that God has the power to bless the generous hearted. That those who learn that spirit of sowing bountifully in the truth will in turn receive a loving response from the Father himself. God has the power to bless those who are generous-hearted in their spirit. And then in verses 12 to 14, the Apostle goes on to draw his thoughts to a conclusion concerning the tremendous benefits of unity and thanksgiving that would be accomplished in the presentation of the fund. And finally, in the 15th verse, he gives the final example that he's going to bring out in these two chapters. Remember, he's brought out the example of the Macedonians. He's brought out the example of the commissioners of the fund. He's brought out the example of Israel of the past. He's brought out the example of his own attitude, of meticulous honesty. Now he's going to bring forth, finally, the example of God himself in the final verse of this chapter as he thanks God for God's own unspeakable gift to us, a final prayer of gratitude uttered by the Apostle. Well then, verses 8 to 11, God's power to bless the generous hearted. Now, you need to just think about these words as we go through verse 8. Verse 8 says, "And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that ye always, having all sufficiency in all things, may abound to every good work." God is able. Let's just come through from the 8th chapter onwards and see how many times the word God appears in these two chapters. Where's the first one? How many times does the word God appear, or is there reference to God in these chapters? So where's the first one? Well, it's obviously chapter 8, verse 1, isn't it? "Moreover, brethren, we do you to wit of the grace of God bestowed on the ecclesias of Macedonia." So chapter 8, verse 1. So there's the first reference to God. Where's the next one? Verse 5, quite right. They gave themselves unto the Lord and unto us by the will of God. All right, so there's the second time that God is referred to. Where's the next one? Yes, the next one is all the way down to verse 16. But thanks be to God, which put the same earnest care into the heart of Titus for you. So, chapter 8, verse 16, that's three times. Where's the next one? Well, there is another one, technically, I suppose, in chapter 8, because remember in verse 21, providing for honest things, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. Remember, that's a quotation from Proverbs chapter 3 and from the Septuagint version. And in the Septuagint version of Proverbs, it's providing for honest things in the sight of God. So the word Lord there is really a reference to God himself. So there's four references. Now the one that you've mentioned, yes, correctly, the next one would be chapter 9, verse 7, wouldn't it? For God loves a cheerful giver. How many times is that so far? So chapter 8, verse 1, verse 5, verse 16, verse 21, and chapter 9, verse 7. That's five times the word God has appeared in these two chapters. Now look at the balance of chapter 9, verse 8. And God is able to make all grace. Verse 10. Now he that ministereth seed, and the he of verse 10 is a reference to God. It's a quotation from Isaiah 55. Verse 11. Through us, thanksgiving to God. Verse 12, many thanksgivings unto God. Verse 13, they glorify God. Verse 14, the exceeding grace of God. Verse 15, thanks be unto God. It's not too difficult to work out what the dominant theme of this last section is all about. These last verses now are all about the fact that it is God's goodness that is the ultimate basis of our inspiration in the truth. The apostle hasn't really referred to this so far, but now he's going to deal very extensively with God's spirit of grace and God's spirit of giving. And because he's talking about God, you'll notice now how the superlatives are to be found in the 8th verse. Just read verse 8 again. Now let's give verse 8 the proper emphasis. And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that ye always, having all sufficiency in all things, may abound to every good. Could you have any more superlatives than that? You couldn't have any more than that, could you? Because, you see, he's now talking about God's power. And there is no limit to what God can do. And so the apostle piles superlative upon superlative as he now talks about what God does in the extension of his spirit towards us. This is all about God's influence. What were the three key words of these two chapters? Remember the three key words? Grace, abound, and minister. And where does it all come from? Verse 8. And God is able to make all grace abound towards you. Verse 10. Now he that ministereth seed to the sower, both minister bread for your food. And so the spirit of these two chapters, and even the key verses, finally come from God's own spirit himself. God's the giver. God's the one who is able to make all grace abound. God is the one who is able to extend that spirit of his own grace abundantly in ministering to the needs of the poor. These are divine principles. God himself does that. So when we take up the spirit of these two chapters, what we're really doing is manifesting the Father. This is the Father's character, to make all grace abound towards others in a work of ministering to their needs. And that's what these verses are all about. Now let's read verse 8. I'm going to read this time from the 20th century New Testament translation, just to try and capture a little further the sense of the verse. God has the power, because the word able there is dunamis, God has the power to shower upon you every kind of blessing in abundance, so that having in all things and on all occasions a full supply for all your wants, you may be able to do an abundance of good actions of every kind. Now you see the spirit of the verse. God is able to give you everything so that you in turn might abound to every good work. That's God manifestation. That we give on the basis of how God has blessed us. And if we do give, God is able to bless us in return. So God is able to bless those who are generous-hearted in their spirit. He'll make his grace abound towards us. Now look at verse 9. As it is written, he says, he hath dispersed abroad, he hath given to the poor, his righteousness remaineth forever. Now you'll remember that in the 7th verse, the apostle drew much of his argument from a particular chapter of Deuteronomy. Anyone remember what the chapter was? It was Deuteronomy 15, that's right. Now come back and have a look at Deuteronomy 15, because I believe that Deuteronomy 15 and the spirit of that chapter was in fact, it loomed large in the mind of the apostle as he moves on now into this next section of 2 Corinthians 9. And the spirit of Deuteronomy 15 is going to be the very principle that the apostle now expounds in these next few verses. Now do you know that Deuteronomy 15 has got three key words? And those three key words expound an idea. Now, here's the three key words. Deuteronomy 15, verse 4. Save when there shall be no poor among you. There's the first key word. There it is again in verse 7. If there be among you a poor man, at the end of the verse, nor shut thine hand from thy poor brother. Halfway through verse 9, thine eye be evil against thy poor brother. Verse 11. For the poor shall never cease out of the land. Therefore I command thee, saying, thou shalt open thine hand wide unto thy brother to thy poor. So there's the first key word. The poor. Now here's the second key word in Deuteronomy 15, or at least the second key idea. Verse 6. Yahweh thy God blesseth thee as he promised thee, and thou shalt lend. It's the word lend there. Verse 8 again. Thou shalt surely lend him sufficient. Verse 10, thou shalt surely give him. And thine heart shall not be grieved when thou givest unto him. So the second key word is the idea of giving or lending. So the first is the poor. There are those that are poor. The second key word is giving to their need. And here's the third key word, verse 4 again. Save when there shall be no poor among you, for Yahweh shall greatly bless thee. Verse 6, Yahweh thy God blesseth thee. Verse 10, and here's the spirit of the chapter. Thou shalt surely give him, and thine heart shall not be grieved when thou givest unto him, because that for this thing Yahweh thy God shall bless thee in all thy works. You see those key words woven into the story of care for others in Deuteronomy 15. Those that are poor, those that have the spirit of giving for the needs of others, and God's power to bless those who have been so minded in their spirit and in their attitude. That's the theme that the apostle now weaves into the 2nd of Corinthians chapter 9, and he takes his impulse from the spirit of Deuteronomy 15. Now coming back to the 2nd of Corinthians chapter 9 just briefly, because we're going to move away from it almost straight away, but just to make sure that we've got the thread of what we're saying here. So in the 2nd of Corinthians 9, reading again from verse 8, so God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that ye always, having all sufficiency in all things, may abound to every good work, as it is written, he hath dispersed abroad, he hath given to the poor. Now there's two of the key words out of Deuteronomy. His righteousness remaineth forever. Now this is actually a quote from Psalm 112, and this is a very interesting passage that the apostle uses. We might just come back to it and have a look at this one, because there's more to this than meets the eye. Psalm 112. So God is able to bless us if we abound towards others, as it is written, he quotes Psalm 112, verse 9. Verse 9 says of Psalm 112, he hath dispersed, he hath given to the poor. And the third key word, by the way, out of Deuteronomy, verse 2, the generation of the upright shall be blessed. Verse 1, blessed is the man that feareth Yahweh. So given to the poor and blessed by God as a result is the theme of Psalm 112. That's the spirit of Deuteronomy chapter 15. Now the thing that we've got to be careful of though with Psalm 112 verse 9 is this. He hath dispersed, he hath given to the poor, his righteousness endureth forever. Now, what may not be clear from a first consideration of this psalm is that the term righteousness here is being used, I believe, in a very special and specific sense. There is a set of passages that speak about the idea of righteousness, but what it really means is almsgiving. The giving of alms. And because the giving of alms was a righteous act, it's deemed to be in itself righteousness. Not that it justifies a man necessarily before God, but it is the doing of that which is right, the giving of alms. And I believe that the word righteousness in this particular passage, it isn't just the general idea of righteousness, it is specifically the righteousness of giving alms. Now I'm going to show you just two or three passages to see how we build that idea up. Come back to Deuteronomy chapter 24 first of all. Just a handful of passages then that bring this idea together. What did Psalm 112 mean when it says that the man who gives to the poor finds that his righteousness endures forever? What does that mean? Well, it means something very special. Deuteronomy 24 puts it this way. Now, let's just have a look then at Deuteronomy 24, verse 10 for connection. So here's an illustration of how this term righteousness is used in this way. When thou dost lend thy brother anything, thou shalt not go into his house to fetch his pledge. Thou shalt stand abroad. And the man to whom thou dost lend shall bring out the pledge abroad unto thee. And if the man be poor, thou shalt not sleep with his pledge. In any case, thou shalt deliver him the pledge again when the sun goeth down, that he may sleep in his own raiment and bless thee, and it shall be righteousness unto thee before Yahweh thy God. So what was the righteousness of the person in this chapter? And the answer is that he has given back to the poor that pledge which he needs. In this particular case, it was the raiment of the man. What was the righteousness counted before God? And that is that he showed mercy to the poor. Isn't that right in that context? It shall be right. What's he done? He's given his pledge back to a poor man again. And it shall be righteousness unto thee, says Deuteronomy 24. Come and have a look at Daniel chapter 4. You might not be convinced with one or two of these, but by the time you see them all in context, you'll see that there is a definite idea here. Daniel chapter 4. And verse 27. Daniel 4, verse 27. Wherefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable unto thee, and break off thy sins by righteousness, and thine iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. Now you see, that's a Hebrew parallelism, isn't it? You see the parallel of expression here. Break off thy sins by righteousness, that is, thine iniquities, by showing mercy to the poor. So what was the righteousness of this man on this occasion? And the answer is that he shows mercy to the poor. That's the spirit of Deuteronomy 24. It shall be counted as righteousness unto thee. Come and have a look at Matthew chapter 6. Here's a New Testament illustration of the same principle. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 1. Take heed that ye do not your alms before men. See the margin? Righteousness. So the giving of gifts for the poor was deemed to be their righteousness. Now I believe that that's the meaning of the term righteousness in Psalm 112. Come back to Psalm 112 and let's just have a look at that again. Now let's have a look at the spirit of the good man of Psalm 112. Is he the spirit that the apostle is speaking about in the 2 Corinthians 9? Well, we're told in verse 4, unto the upright, Psalm 112 verse 4, unto the upright there ariseth light in darkness. He is gracious and full of compassion. Verse 5, a good man showeth favour and lendeth. You see the spirit of this man? Verse 9, he hath dispersed, he hath given to the poor. You see, the spirit of this one is that he shows mercy to those in need. And as a result of that, says verse 9, his righteousness endureth forever. And I believe that the phrase his righteousness there, in the context of Deuteronomy 24, Daniel 4, Matthew chapter 6, that the righteousness of this good man is his ability to keep on giving alms to the poor. It endures forever. On the one hand, he gives to the poor, and as fast as he's giving to the poor with one hand, he finds that God is blessing him with the other, so that his ability to give alms, his righteousness, endures forever. It keeps going. You see verse 3? Wealth and riches shall be in his house, and his righteousness endureth forever. There's always, somehow, seemingly, a supply that he can turn around and give to others. So Psalm 112 is a more powerful passage than you might think that the apostle weaves into the 2 Corinthians 9, because it's a passage about those that give to the poor. And that's the righteousness, I believe, of this verse. And there was a verb in here also in this psalm for the spirit of the Judaizer, verse 10 of Psalm 112. Because when the Jerusalem Poor Fund arrived, the thinking of the apostle was indeed that the wicked shall see it and be grieved. He shall gnash with his teeth and melt away, and the desire of the wicked shall perish. Because the spirit of the man who gives to the poor, whose righteousness remains forever, was to be seen in that collection. And the apostle earnestly wished that that might be so, and that the spirit of the Judaizers would thus be quenched when the fund arrived in Jerusalem. Now let's come back. Oh, actually, before I do that, so you see what we're saying? That verse 9 of Psalm 112, which is what Paul quotes in 2 Corinthians, what it really means is that the person that gives to the poor finds that God blesses them in return, so that their ability to give, their righteousness, is always there. It endures forever. They are able to keep on giving to the poor, that it might be deemed to be their righteousness, because they in turn have discovered the secret of giving. Now, let's just illustrate the truth of that from several parallel references in the book of Proverbs that are almost identical to the spirit of Psalm 112. So here's the first one. He that hath pity upon the poor lendeth unto Yahweh. And that which he hath given will he, that is God, pay him again. So just as with the spirit of the good man of Psalm 112, he gives to the poor, but God gives it back to him. His righteousness endures forever, in the words of Psalm 112. Why does his righteousness endure forever? Because God gives back to him, in a sense, what he's given. What about Proverbs 22 and verse 9? He that hath a bountiful eye shall be blessed, for he giveth of his bread to the poor. And so what happens to this man who gives to the poor? He's blessed. There's the three key words out of Deuteronomy 15. He gives to the poor and is blessed in return. His righteousness, therefore, remains forever. He's always able to keep giving to the poor because God blesses him. Here's another one. Proverbs 28, verse 27. He that giveth to the poor shall not lack, but he that hideth his eyes shall have many a curse. So you see, the spirit of these three proverbs, Proverbs chapter 19, verse 17, Proverbs chapter 22, verse 9, and Proverbs 28, verse 27, the spirit of these passages is, in each case, the spirit of Psalm 112. Let's just underline their colour in the key ideas. So Psalm 112 says that the man who's captured this spirit, his righteousness remains forever. That is his ability to give alms. Why? Because God pays him back again. God blesses him. He shall not lack, because there's an everlasting cycle that somehow that person has tapped into, and it's the cycle of God's blessing of them in return. Now come back to the 2 Corinthians chapter 9, and let's just try and see that that is the spirit of what the apostle's first of all talking about, and why in fact he has used the quotation from Psalm 112. So in the 2 Corinthians chapter 9, let's read from verse 8 again, just to make sure that that is the sense of the passage. So verse 8 says, God is able to make all grace abound, so that you, having all things that you need, may abound to others in every good work. As it is written, he hath dispersed abroad, he hath given to the poor, his righteousness, his ability to give alms, his ability to extend mercy to the poor remaineth forever, because God's blessed him so that he can do that. Verse 10, now he that ministereth seed to the sower, both minister bread for your food, and multiply your seed sown, and increase the fruits of your righteousness. So now we've got another Bible passage. In the ninth verse, the apostle is drawing from Psalm 112. Where's he drawing from in the 10th verse? What Old Testament passage in the main can we think of that the apostle is drawing from in the next verse? I'd like to have a crack at that. He that ministereth seed to the sower. Well, that is really Isaiah 55. It is in the margin. Don't be frightened. That was the correct answer. Let's come and have a look at Isaiah 55. He that ministers bread to the sower, seed to the sower. Now let's have a look at the spirit then of Isaiah 55. Now Isaiah 55 says, verse 10, for as the rain cometh down, and the snow from heaven, and returneth not thither, but watereth the earth, and maketh it to bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower. There's the reference. That it may give seed to the sower, and bread to the eater. Now, what does verse 10 say of Isaiah 55? You know, it seems to say that as the rain cometh down, and returneth not thither. Is that what it says? The rain comes down, and it returneth not thither. Is that what verse 10 says of Isaiah 55? Hands up those that think yes. Hands up those that think no. Hands up those that aren't sure. Hands up those that don't think at all. So you see, Isaiah 55 verse 10 appears to say that the rain comes down, but it doesn't return thither. But that's actually not what it's saying at all, because you see, the rain of verse 10 is parallel with God's word, isn't it, verse 11? So let's have a look, first of all, at what happens to the word. So shall my word be that goeth forth out of my mouth. It shall not return unto me void. Ah, so you see, when it says it shall not return, it doesn't mean so much that it's not coming back, but that it won't return void. But it shall accomplish that which I please, and it shall prosper in the thing whereto I sent it. Now, what does happen to the rain? The rain comes down. Where does it go? Where does it go, by the way? Where does the rain go? Sorry? It goes into the earth. Where does it go then? Into the rivers, yes. Having got into the earth, where does it go? Yeah, there's a brother over here that can only speak with sign language. Brother, the recording brother. It's quite right, Brian. What happens to the water, of course, is that it comes down, doesn't it? And when it comes up through the plants and through the trees. And it comes up through the trunk and out into the branches and out into the leaves and is expired back into the atmosphere. And eventually the water returns, doesn't it? And then it comes down again. So you see, what verse 10 of Isaiah 55 really means is that when the rain comes down, it doesn't return thither, but that first it waters the earth, and makes it to bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater. So what really happens is that when the water comes down, it goes back to God, all right, but in the very process of returning, up come shoots and buds and plants and leaves, and there's growth and beauty, and all that is accomplished as the water comes back, and is a mysterious multiplication of other things that are done just in the water going back to God. That's what my word's like, says God. Verse 11. When I send my word forth, it won't return unto me void, but it comes back in the process of having changed the hearts of many people, that eventually the whole earth might be filled with my glory in the very returning of the word unto me, the very purpose for which I've sent it. So there's a mysterious cycle of life, isn't there? And somehow in that mysterious cycle, the word goes forth and the water goes forth, and in the very bringing of it back to God, it somehow multiplies up all sorts of other marvellous things that are grown and developed thereby. Now that's a marvellous passage for the Apostle to quote. Let's go back to 2 Corinthians 9 and see exactly, well, let's see what the Apostle does say and why does he make allusion to that passage. Well, he says, verse 10 of 2 Corinthians 9, "Now he that ministereth seed to the sower, both minister bread for your food, and multiply your seed sown, and increase the fruits of your righteousness." So you see, there's three different things here, isn't there? When you read verse 10 carefully, there's three different things that happen. He that ministereth seed to the sower, what's he going to do? Both minister bread for your food, that's the first thing, and secondly, multiply your seed sown. And thirdly, increase the fruits of your righteousness. So there's three things. In the paradox of learning to give, there are three things as far as the use of the seed is concerned here. There's that, first of all, which must be... So here's the store of seed that a person starts off at the start of the year. He says, well, I've got to take some of my seed and we're going to eat it. So that's the bit that says, minister bread for your food. Some of the seed is going to go into that. And some of it is, multiply your seed sown. Some of it's got to be sown for the future in hope of a harvest to come. But there's also some, a third portion. You see what it says here in verse 10? Increase the fruits of your righteousness. Now be careful here. You see, how has the apostle used the term righteousness in the ninth verse, in quoting from Psalm 112? It's the same sense here. What does the righteousness stand for here in this chapter? It's the righteousness of the person who gives to the poor, isn't it? Remember that? So what sort of righteousness is going to be increased here? The righteousness of generosity to others. Now listen to some other translations to see how that sense is captured in the translating of that last phrase of verse 10. Increase the fruits of your righteousness. Moffat says, he will increase the crop of your charities. Weymouth says, he will increase the benefits wrought by your almsgiving. That's how he translates the words righteousness. The New English Bible says, he will multiply and swell the harvest of your benevolence. That's the word righteousness. So you see, those translations took up the idea of the word righteousness there, and they say, yes, it relates in this particular verse to the giving of alms to the poor, that spirit of generosity to others. So the seed's divided. Each person has seed, and it's divided in three ways: that which must be eaten, that which must be sown, that which must be given. And what this verse says, remember, quoting from Isaiah 55, what this verse says, in effect, is that when we learn the secret of giving, that in fact there is a somehow a mysterious multiplication process, and it returns back to us multiplied up, even though we've given it. Now, look what happens. We take of our seed, and we eat, and we sow, and we give, and yet somehow, in that very cycle of generosity, we get back more than we started with. And the whole process is able to begin all over again. And God has the power to bless the generous hearted. And there is somehow a mysterious multiplication of that which we have. The very lessons of harvest tell us that. When harvest ripens, there's an indication of that marvelous spirit of God's giving to the earth. Harvest is the standard of God's giving, isn't it? We've actually got to believe in that as a principle for life. You know what this is really telling us? What it's telling us is that giving doesn't mean losing. Because one will find, strangely enough, that as we learn the secret of giving in the truth, of giving in life, that we somehow get it all back and more besides through some mysterious magic, as it were, whereby God is able to multiply things up for us. Verse 10, he that ministers seed to the sower, both minister bread for your food and multiply your seed and increase the fruits of your generosity to others. I believe that that's one of the reasons why the apostle says in Acts chapter 20, in quoting the Lord Jesus Christ, he says that we ought to remember the words of the Lord Jesus when he said it is more, what's the quotation? It is more blessed to give than to receive. Do you know why? Well, one of the reasons why is because the man or the woman that learns to give does receive. They get it all back and more besides. There's a secret to life here in the way that we approach our everyday life, our family life, our ecclesial life. Have we really locked onto that secret of giving our hearts for the work of the truth? Because God's able to give it all back to us in a way that we don't even really, properly, truly understand. But it works. It does, says the apostle. Believe me, says the apostle, it works. Now, you've got to be careful here, because it doesn't mean that if you put $10 more into the collection each Sunday that you're necessarily going to get a $10 a week pay rise. It's not as specific as that, is it? We may give money for the work of the truth and in fact have financial woes. It's not saying that we will be repaid in kind. We don't know exactly how it will work. But what the apostle says is that God will make his grace to abound towards you in various ways. And sometimes the way in which we're recompensed by God is in quite a different way to what we've given. But we're still recompensed. And those that find the truth of that principle are those that say, you know, it's an amazing thing that God's blessed us so abundantly. You know, there are people like that in ecclesias, aren't there? That are full of the blessings that God has graciously bestowed upon them. You'll often find that those people also have given much to others. They've locked into a secret of life in the truth. Now, you see what the apostle goes on to say in verse 11. In fact, you've got to note first of all. No, actually, before I move on to verse 11, I should just quote something else that's significant here. So you see, this is interesting, isn't it? Because these arms that were in this bag, this collection, is actually, if you like, you can describe it as their righteousness. That's the way it's described here, isn't it? Their righteousness was in that bag. You know, he was going to go back to Jerusalem. And he was going to plonk the bags on the table. And he was going to look up to the Judaizers and he was going to say, what shall we say then? That the Gentiles, which followed not after righteousness, have attained to righteousness, even the righteousness which is of faith. All those bags were going to be a testimony of that spirit, weren't they? Unanswerable, really. And that's what the apostle hoped would be the case. Now, you notice that in verse 11 he says, being enriched in everything to all bountifulness. But did you notice that verses 9 and 10 are in brackets? So, you see, we really should read from verse 8 straight through to verse 11. You see, what the apostle says is, verse 8, God is able to abound in grace towards us so that we can in turn bless others. Oh, now, a couple of quotations that we ought to think about in that context. Psalm 112, about the fact that our ability to give will be preserved by God. And Isaiah 55 and verse 10, the way that God himself experiences that principle of giving forth of his goodness and receiving it back, multiplied up. Now, back onto the subject, verse 11, being enriched in everything. So, you see, the verses in between 9 and 10 are almost a digression as the apostle weaves in those two references from Psalm 112 and Isaiah 55. So let's read verse 8 and then straight through to verse 11. And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that ye always, having all sufficiency in all things, may abound to every good work, being enriched in everything to all bountifulness, which causeth through us thanksgiving to God. Being enriched, says the apostle, in everything. You notice that? You know what he's saying? What the apostle is saying here is that if we can learn the secret of giving in the truth, it will enrich our lives in everything. Not just in spiritual matters or temporal matters, in everything. It's a paradox, you see. What he's saying in verse 11 is that giving will enrich us. Isn't that a paradox? Learning the secret of giving will actually enrich our lives. And you know, one of the reasons for that is that when we learn the spirit of care for others and we are concerned about others and concerned to give for the needs of others, somehow our own problems shrink back in size, don't they? You ever notice that? If your life is full of care and concern and giving for others, somehow your own problems don't seem as bad. But if you're always thinking about yourself and brooding on yourself, your own problems loom larger and larger, don't they, in mind? Learn the secret of giving. You'll find that even the difficulties and circumstances of your own life that are a trial to you will somehow, and maybe that's part of the blessing of God, will somehow be diminished as we're enriched in other ways. But the apostle sounds a note of warning in verse 11 because he says, being enriched in everything to all bountifulness. And whilst it's true that the word could mean bountifulness, the real meaning of the Greek word is singleness. Singleness. It's a reference here not to the act of giving. It's not talking about their act of giving, but the motive behind their giving. They must give in singleness. God is one. And the moral force of the oneness of God is that we also must be single-minded about the truth. And even in this matter of giving for the needs of the poor, there was a great need to ensure that they gave in singleness of heart. There were to be no ulterior motives, no secret pride, no self-elevation. Sometimes we can do that, can't we? You know, there's been some activity on in ecclesial life. We almost sort of, you know, well, did a pretty good job there, I think. I think I gave quite a lot, really. That's not the spirit of giving, is it? We've got to give in singleness of heart. And the singleness with which we give is that the cause of the truth itself may be advanced. That's all we should be thinking about. Is that in whatever we've given, is that the cause of the truth might be advanced. And the apostle was anxious that the spirit with which they did give would be in that singleness of mind. And then he goes on to say in verse 11, now this is interesting, he says, being enriched in everything to all singleness, which causes through us thanksgiving to God. Now, why do you think he says causes through us? Why does he mention causes through us, do you think, at this particular time? What's the meaning of that? Causes through us thanksgiving to God. Why was the thanksgiving that would be caused through him? Any thoughts on that? Why through him? Well, there was a reason. And the reason is simple enough, really. In fact, the 20th century New Testament translation translates verse 11, your generosity, which through our instrumentality produces thanksgiving to God. Through our instrumentality, because the apostle was going to journey back to Jerusalem with the fund, wasn't he? And so he was going to be the one, with all the other delegates, of course, who was going to go back to Jerusalem and present the fruits of their righteousness, verse 10. And through us, he sees that time when thanksgiving to God would abound, through our instrumentality, because now he's made the decision that he also will accompany the fund back to Jerusalem. Do you know something, brothers and sisters? When the apostle wrote this in the 2 Corinthians chapter 9, and he says that all this wonderful thing will be done through our instrumentality, do you know that even the apostle didn't realise how true that would be? Come back to Acts chapter 20 just for a moment. Even the apostle didn't realise the fullness of what he was saying in that phrase. Being enriched in everything to all bountifulness, which causes thanksgiving through us, thanksgiving shall be brought forth unto God. Remember in Acts chapter 20, we have the story of the delegates. You'll remember that we're told of the delegates from the various parts of the ecclesial world. We looked at this in our opening studies. So remember, the two delegates from Galatia were in fact Gaius of Derbe and Timothy of Lystra. The two delegates from Asia were Tychicus and Trophimus, both from Ephesus. We believe that the delegates from Macedonia were, well, we're told, verse 4, Sopater of Berea, Aristarchus and Secundus of Thessalonica, and we believe Luke of the ecclesia of Philippi. And that's very appropriate, isn't it? Because with regard to the spirit of these places, two delegates from Galatia, two delegates from Asia, four delegates from Macedonia. How appropriate that would be in terms of the generosity of the Macedonian ecclesias. But did you notice the other night that we never ever did mention, did we, who were the delegates from the province of Achaia? Well, who are they? They're in Acts chapter 20, by the way. You've just got to work out who they are. Well, it can't be Sopater, Aristarchus, Secundus, Gaius, Timotheus, Tychicus, or Trophimus, or Luke, because we've already got all those ones. So who else could there be in this company? Who else could there be who could be delegates of the only other area that we haven't looked at yet? We know that they gave, because remember Romans 15 says it has pleased them of Achaia to make a certain contribution. The question was, who represented Achaia in taking their collections back? Good answer. Titus. So why isn't he in the list of Acts chapter 20? And the answer is, because Luke's writing the story, and Titus was his brother, and Luke doesn't even mention that he was a delegate, apart from the change of pronouns, so he's certainly not going to write his brother into the narrative. But how appropriate that it should be Titus, who'd been there on at least two occasions to stimulate the Achaian ecclesias into giving. And guess who else? Why not Paul? I believe it was. Let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. So we'd then have two delegates from Achaia, wouldn't we? Paul and Titus. You see, what better way could the ecclesias of Achaia, when Paul finally arrived in Corinth, as he did in Acts 20, and lived there for 3 months, verse 3, what better way could the Achaian ecclesias say, look, Paul, we got your epistle. We read the 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. We're ever so thankful for what you said to us. In fact, we're so thankful and we're so at one with your spirit concerning that fund, that Paul, we'd like you to be our delegate. Now, what an end to the story that would have been. There are no other delegates mentioned in Acts chapter 20. And yet we know that there must have been representatives for Achaia. So coming back to the 2 Corinthians chapter 9, and remember, I think the apostle probably didn't know that himself, as he writes this 11th verse of the chapter, and he says, being enriched in everything to all bountifulness, which causes through us, through our instrumentality, thanksgiving to God. I think that even the apostle himself didn't really appreciate the fullness of what that would mean. That he would indeed, finally, be the very one who would accompany their own personal collections to Jerusalem. Causes through us, says verse 11, thanksgiving to God. So you see, the collection was going to do two things, verse 11. First of all, verse 12. The administration of this service, verse 12, not only supplies the want of the saints, but is abundant also by many thanksgivings. So it was going to do two things. It was going to supply the want of the saints, a practical need, and it was also going to generate thanksgivings to God. So the gift solved their poverty, practical problem, but also would change, hopefully, the spiritual attitude of those who receive the gift. So who gives the thanksgiving to God in verses 11 and 12? And the answer is, of course, the Jewish brethren of Judea who would receive the gift. It was going to come through the instrumentality of the apostle, but it was the Jewish brethren themselves that would give the thanksgiving to God as a result of the reception of this gift. And so the apostle says in verse 12, he says, the administration of this service, the administration of this service, says the apostle. And in the Greek, the word service is liturgia. Now, that's not a common word, is it? Liturgia, it's the word from which liturgy comes. It's used in the Septuagint translation almost exclusively of sacrificial services. It denotes priestly service. If we come back to Romans 15, and remember, Paul wrote Romans 15 on the very eve of his departure with the fund. Here's the spirit, of course, of that word liturgos, and in the very context of what the apostle had in mind. Romans 15 and verse 16. He says there that I should be the minister of Jesus Christ to the Gentiles, and the word minister there is the Greek word again, liturgos, that I should be the priestly minister of Jesus Christ to the Gentiles, ministering the gospel of God, that the offering up of the Gentiles might be acceptable. You know, that's the very spirit that the apostle had in mind here in the 2 Corinthians chapter 9. He says, verse 12, the administration of this priestly service. And so what the apostle, look, I'll tell you what's happening in these verses, brothers and sisters. The apostle's mind is just, as he writes the story to a conclusion, his apostle's mind just wanders off into the heights. The apostle, he just loses himself in a reverie of seeing what's going to happen. The apostle's mind is already in Jerusalem. He's writing to the Corinthians, to the Achaeans, but already the apostle's heart and mind has gone to Jerusalem, and he sees himself there as the priest of the Gentiles, offering up the sacrifice of the Gentiles, and the sacrifice of the Gentiles was the collection of the money itself. And here was their offering, and he was going to be the priest. Now that's how the apostle saw this. He had a marvelously lofty mind, didn't he? So 2 Corinthians 9, verse 12, for the administration of this priestly service, he says, not only supplies the want of the saints, but is also abundant by many thanksgivings to God. As the New English Bible says, it overflows in a flood of thanksgiving to God. Moffat says, it overflows with many a cry of thanksgiving to God. Verse 13, whilst by the experiment of this ministration, they glorify God for your professed subjection unto the gospel of Christ and for your liberal distribution unto them and unto all men. You know, when it says whilst by the experiment, that's probably not a good translation, because the word really means the test or proof. This wasn't just an experiment, brothers and sisters. This was concrete evidence of the love of the Gentiles for their Jewish brethren. So instead of translating it while by the experiment of this ministration, well, Weymouth says by the evidence of this service. Here was going to be absolute proof of how the Gentiles felt. And what would the Jewish brethren react like? It says there that they will glorify God for your professed subjection unto the gospel of Christ and for your liberal distribution. The word liberal is the same word as bountiful in verse 11. It means single. And the word distribution here is the word koinonia, which is fellowship, of course. So they will bless God, they will glorify God for your single-minded fellowship unto them. You know, it's interesting the way the apostle writes this, because, you see, he's writing to the Gentiles. You see, if he'd been writing to Jews, he would have stressed a whole lot of other reasons. You see, he doesn't say, does he, when he writes these last few verses, he doesn't say, well, by the time we take the money back to Jerusalem, it will deal a death blow to Judaism. I mean, that's what he wanted, but he doesn't say that, does he? Because he's writing to the Gentiles. What he stresses to the Gentiles is the marvellous effect that he believes and hopes and prays that it will have on their Jewish brethren in terms of binding them all together, that they, that their Jewish brethren will glorify God for your single-minded fellowship with them. You see, here was the point. How could the brethren of Judea, how could they accept these Gentile contributions unless they also accepted the brethren who had given the contributions? If Judea accepted the fund, they had to also accept the brethren who'd given the fund. That's what the apostle wanted, wasn't it? His heart's desire was that Jew and Gentile might be bound together in this act of service, that the Jewish brethren might see their subjection to the gospel and their single-minded fellowship with them. Oh, says Paul, I do hope that that will be the case. And not only that, he says, verse 14, and by their prayer for you, which long after you in the exceeding grace of God in you. And so the apostle now sees the brethren of Judea not only accepting the gift and having their needs satisfied, but that these Jewish brethren would now lift up their prayer for Gentiles. Here would be the prayer now of the Jewish brethren for their Gentiles, for their Gentile brethren. And Moffat says, they are drawn to you and pray for you because of the surpassing grace of God which rests upon you. Now you see, in these verses, verses 12 to 14, it's almost as if the apostle, well, he just lets go. And he lets his mind just wander away to what he now hopes and dreams of what this whole gathering will accomplish. So what does he see? He sees Jew and Gentile bound together. He sees the poverty that was desperately there in the Judean ecclesias alleviated. But he also sees the Jewish brethren with a changed heart and mind. He sees them now accepting of the Gentiles. He sees them lifting up their prayers for the Gentiles. He sees them down on their knees with a chorus of thanksgivings to God. He sees the humility of the Jewish brethren as they're bound together with their Gentile brethren. Oh, if the apostle could see all of that. These verses are Paul's own heart in this matter. That's what he wanted. That's what he prayed about. That's what he desired. And then he finishes in the 15th verse with this remarkable statement. Thanks be unto God, he says, as he concludes his considerations. Thanks be unto God for his unspeakable gift. The word thanks there is the Greek word charis again. Grace be to God for his unspeakable gift. You know, the word gift there, the word gift in this verse is the Greek word doria. It means a free gift. The stress is on the word free. It comes from the Greek word doron, which means a present, but especially a sacrifice. And when the apostle says, thanks be unto God for his unspeakable gift, the word unspeakable means literally that which is indescribable, that which is inexpressible, that which is inestimable. What he's saying is that the gift of God that he has in mind is something that's hard to put into words, says the apostle. He says, I find it hard to express. It's inexpressible what God has done in what he's given to us. Now, what was or what is the unspeakable gift of God? Well, the Lord Jesus Christ, on one occasion, in the Gospel of John chapter 4, said these words to a woman by the well. He asked her for water. And she said, well, why would you be asking me, a Samaritan, for water since you're a Jew? You know what the Lord said in return? In John chapter 4 verse 10 he said,
If thou knewest the gift of God, Doria, and who it is that said unto thee, give me to drink, thou would have asked of him water. If thou knewest the gift of God and who it is that spoke with thee. You know who the gift of God was? It's the Lord himself. He was the gift. Now look at these passages. Romans chapter 5 and verse 15. For if through the offence of one many be dead, much more the grace of God and the gift, Doria, by grace, which is by one man, Jesus Christ, hath abounded unto many. The gift of God was shown in the fact that he gave his only begotten Son as a sacrifice for us. Romans chapter 8, verses 31 and 32. If God be for us, who can be against us? He that spared not his own Son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? Wasn't that the unspeakable gift? And of course, what about John 3, verse 16? For God so loved the world that he gave. There's the word. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. And the indescribable, inexpressible, unspeakable gift that Yahweh gave was finally his own Son for the sins of the world. You know what the apostle's saying in this final verse? What he's saying as he comes to the conclusion of these two marvellous chapters, he says, you know what, brothers and sisters? Whatever you give, you can never ever hope to match what God gave. Because Yahweh himself is the supreme giver. We'll never give what he's given. And even if we endeavour to fulfil that spirit of giving to the needs of others all our life, we'll only be a faint shadow of the wonder of what God has done for us. There's the moving spirit, says the apostle, finally, to whatever we do. It's the Father himself who is the great giver. And in giving for others, says the apostle, all we're doing faintly is echoing the spirit of God himself. Grace be unto God for his unspeakable gift. Now, brothers and sisters, I want you to hear the words of the closing hymn, which take up the spirit of this passage. O Lord of heaven and earth and sea, to thee all praise and glory be. How shall we show our love to thee, who givest all? The golden sunshine, vernal air, sweet flowers and fruit thy love declare. When harvests ripen, thou art there, who givest all. For peaceful homes and healthful days, for all the blessings earth displays, we owe thee thankfulness and praise. Thanks be unto God, who givest all. thou didst not spare thine only Son, but gavest him for a world undone, and freely with that blessed one thou givest all. Thanks be unto God, brothers and sisters, for his unspeakable gift.